From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Medical College of Wisconsin prepares to open new campuses in other parts of the state and sees them as a win now and in the future.
If the students live and learn in the communities, they'll have an affinity for the communities, develop role models, like the lifestyle, and decide to stay there for their practice.
Then a new book tells the story of a Midwestern sanctuary for wild Mustangs. We'll get an audio glimpse inside a Brookfield facility that makes some of the equestrian industry's best-regarded equipment.
I walk in, and every morning I am so proud of what we do. Giving people a tour of our shop gives me the chills. After 10 years, it still amazes me that it turns from a hide of leather into the beautiful quality that we manufacture. It's amazing that we do it right here in Brookfield.
And we'll learn about the new novel, Saving Kandinsky. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The Milwaukee area's only medical school announced 2 years ago that it planned to expand to other parts of the state. Leaders at the Medical College of Wisconsin said additional campuses could increase the number of graduates by half and address a variety of issues, not the least of which is a projected shortage of physicians. 2 years later, the two new campuses are moving forward at slightly different rates. Dr. John Raymond is president of the Medical College of Wisconsin. He told Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why it's important to establish these regional campuses.
The purpose of expanding our medical school into Green Bay and central Wisconsin is to help address a workforce shortage of physicians, especially in the northern parts of the state. Our idea is that if the students live and learn in the communities, they'll have an affinity for the communities, develop role models, like the lifestyle, and decide to stay there for their practice.
How much is going to be offered at these campuses versus what you already offer in Milwaukee?
Everything that we have here in Milwaukee will be offered up at the regional campuses, and we hope that the faculties at both the regional campuses will be able to start generating some curricular content that can be shared down here in Milwaukee. So we envision that there'll be creation of the curriculum content both in the communities and down here in Milwaukee.
What about the research component? So much of what happens in Milwaukee also involves research. Are the same kinds of opportunities going to exist for people who are studying medicine to be involved in research on these regional campuses?
Yeah, what a fabulous question. Our model definitely will include scholarship and research, but we're not planning to build a significant number of wet bench laboratories. So we hope that the students will participate in clinical trials, community-based participatory research, public health-type research. If the students want to do bench work, they can come down to Milwaukee and have a year of experience. And the beauty of our model is we're delivering the curriculum in 3 years rather than four. So for a student who decides that they do want to take a research year, they can still finish up in 4 years.
Do you envision alliances with regional hospitals for things like residencies as students progress?
Again, another great question. One of the essential features of our model is that we rely almost entirely on partnership with the local educational institutions and the healthcare organizations. And we do want the health systems to help build residency programs for us in the region. The reason for that is if our students go to medical school and they graduate, if they don't have residency programs to go to in the region, they may never come back. And what many people may not understand is that typically to go to medical school, you already have a bachelor's degree at a minimum. Then you traditionally do 4 years of medical school, and we're going to have the 3-year track in the communities, and then at least 3 more years of residency training before you can even think about practicing. So having those destination residencies in central Wisconsin and Green Bay is absolutely critical.
What would attract a medical student to one of these regional campuses versus the larger campus in Milwaukee?
I think many factors. One would be the great quality of life that the residents there enjoy. I think Green Bay I've become very familiar with, and it's a wonderful place for families. You've got the Packers International brand there that's attractive. But I also think our 3-year model is going to be attractive to students that are highly motivated, focused, want to make sure that they have the minimum amount of debt burden when they're done, so they'll be attracted to the 3-year program. students that come from rural parts of the state and want to serve those regions, I think will be attracted to the program because we have three very fine health systems, both in Green Bay and in central Wisconsin, an enormous talent base of sophisticated health care that's delivered there, yet they serve the underserved parts of the state.
Would you anticipate, especially given the nature of these regional campuses, would you anticipate many of the students who will apply for admission are going to be Wisconsin natives to begin with?
That's our goal, and we'll give preferential consideration to students from Wisconsin and students from the areas that we hope to serve. And we think this is one of the beauty of the model. And you may not know this, but about 700 students from Wisconsin apply to medical school every year. Many of them are very qualified and end up matriculating at medical schools outside of the state.
What's the status of the development of these regional campuses?
We're very excited. We've been on a fast track. We received approval from our Board of Trustees to move forward with the regional campus concept in early 2012. And just over the last 2 months, we've received permission from the two accrediting bodies for our medical school and for our entire institution to move forward with recruitment of students to Green Bay. So we'll be matriculating the first class of 20 to 25 students next July.
What sort of infrastructure need is there to create a school from scratch?
Typically, the startup cost for a medical school that would serve 50 students per class runs in the $125 to $150 million range. You need classrooms, you need clinical sites, you need research laboratories, offices, simulation center, anatomy lab. The beauty of our model is that we're using facilities that already exist in the communities. We're sharing faculty. We're able to project the infrastructure that we have here in Milwaukee, including our library offerings, into those communities so that we can drive the cost down. So the total startup and ramp-up cost for these two campuses is about $32 million. So for one-fifth of the cost of a startup medical school, we're able to deliver that quality of education in those two communities.
We haven't talked much about the Central Wisconsin campus. Where do things stand with that?
We're making great progress there. We're a little bit behind Green Bay. We just recruited a fantastic dean, Dr. Lisa Dodson, who's going to be starting in August. We've had our dean for Green Bay since January, Matt Hunsaker, and Lisa's going to do a great job. The challenges in central Wisconsin really have to do with a more dispersed geography. Green Bay is much more compact. The health system partners and the academic partners are all located within a few miles of each other. In central Wisconsin, there's quite a bit of driving distance involved between the partners. And also, quite honestly, one of the principles of our engagement in the communities has been to put in a lot of face time. It's another hour drive for us to go to central Wisconsin. We're very much hoping to matriculate the first students there in July of 2016. So that would be 1 year behind Green Bay.
What about sustainability? You know, there are a lot of institutions of various kinds that have expanded and then found themselves running into difficulties because of expanding too much too quickly. Is that a concern for the medical college?
Well, my Board of Trustees always talks about execution risk and reputation risk. So I would say that we've had discussions about it. In terms of being a concern, I'm very confident that this will be a sustainable model. We've set up the financial model so that the programs can be sustained on the tuition that we charge. So at least in terms of the finances, if we can find 25 quality students per site, which we're very confident of, this should be a sustainable program. We've also invested a considerable amount of time in building partnerships with the communities so that all of us can say this is our medical school, and we think that's also going to be important for sustainability.
And presumably, you still have a lot of work ahead to solve the physician shortage.
We certainly do. There was a study published by the Wisconsin Hospital Association in late 2011 that suggested we were going to be about 2,000 doctors short in the next 20 years. And they recommended that the two medical schools collaborate to train another 100 medical students per year. We're doing our part with the projected 50 new students, which will make the Medical College of Wisconsin be one of the five largest allopathic medical schools in the country in terms of enrollment.
Well, Dr. John Raymond, thank you so much for the status update. Best of luck, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Mitch. I sure hope that I can come back and see you again.
Dr. John Raymond is president and CEO of the Medical College of Wisconsin. He first spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke last month. Coming up next, how an Arizona rancher set up a Midwestern sanctuary to protect the country's wild Mustangs. Lake Effect returns with that story in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Federal Bureau of Land Management announced yesterday it will remove fewer wild horses and burros from western rangeland this year, due primarily to budget constraints. The management of those horses has been a challenge for a long time. One solution that met with some success more than 20 years ago was the establishment of a Mustang sanctuary in the Midwest. It was the work of Arizona rancher Alan Day. The story of that sanctuary is told in a new book he co-wrote with Thiensville native Lynn Wheezy Sneed, called The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. Wheezy Sneed is back in Wisconsin this week, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio to talk with Mitch Tyke about the story of the sanctuary and the horses themselves.
I think they've been the property of the U.S. government for quite a while. They reside on governmental land that is run by the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM. And in 1971, Congress passed a law that wild horses could not be euthanized, they could not be slaughtered, and they were to remain safe. However, they populate at about 20 to 25% a year. So think of it. There's a herd of wild horses, maybe 100, 200 horses on land designated for their use, but if they're populating it, they're overgrazing that land. So what the BLM has to do is call those horses from the land, and they use helicopters to do that, which aggravates many horse lovers because it terrorizes the horses. Then when the horses come off the land, they're put in holding pens. The biggest one is in Reno, Nevada. And they are there for life unless they are adopted by the public. And which horses get adopted? The pretty, the young, the ones that people are interested in owning because they probably look beautiful. And the government has many horses, as in about 40,000, in captivity right now.
And these are wild horses, but they are descended from horses that were used by man.
Yes, yes. The Spanish conquistadors brought them over, and so genetically they are wild horses, and that's another concern, that the genetics will not stay pure, that as they are taken off and the land and maybe bred with other horses, our supply of wild horses in this country will diminish.
So let's turn the clock back to the late 1980s. Before Alan Day stepped in and started a Mustang sanctuary, what was typically the fate of unadoptable Mustangs if they couldn't be legally euthanized?
They lived in this prison, in the corrals, in Nevada, Wyoming, New Mexico, different places in the country. And there they stayed, and the government was paying a certain amount per head to keep them on a daily basis.
This was not really a happy situation in any way.
No, it was not a happy situation.
Well, so give us some background on Alan Day. He had a long love for horses, I gather, but they were not his job before this part of his life.
No, Alan is a native Arizonan, and he grew up on a ranch, 200,000 acres, called Lazy Bee, and it straddled Arizona and New Mexico, and it was a cattle ranch. So that was his job after graduating from the University of Arizona. He went back to the ranch and he managed cattle. And then he also bought a ranch in Nebraska, 45,000 acre ranch, and he ran more, I think it was 2,500 mother cows on that ranch. Being a rancher, however, he had horses all his life. So he grew up on horses and had a great love of horses.
And one of the recurring themes through this book is his thoughts back on some of the remarkable horses he had known and loved.
Yes, right. So there's actually two stories in the book. One is about the wild horses and his experiences with them. But then interwoven are stories about individual ranch horses that he had.
Now, the ranch that ended up becoming Mustang Meadows was not his originally either. How did it end up in his care?
Well, that was kind of a fluke. He did not need another ranch, and he had the one in Arizona and Nebraska. And a real estate agent said, "Oh, Alan, you've got to see this ranch. It's just gorgeous. You're going to love it. I know you. You love it." And he said, "You know, I don't need more land." But finally he gave in and he went to the ranch and he absolutely fell in love with it. He also had an experience, and this man is not prone to this type of experience. He entered the ranch and it was like deja vu. He knew he had been there at some point previous life, whether he believes in that or not, I'm not sure. But he just fell in love with this 35,000 acre, as he calls it, sea of prairie grass.
And as you say, he was not someone who was really – he wasn't a romantic cowboy figure. This is somebody who it kind of snuck up on him.
Right, right. I mean, he's an American cowboy, but he's a businessman and he's a land conservationist. And he has certain business principles that were ingrained in him from his father, who was a cattle rancher, and from his grandfather, who was a cattle rancher. And he broke every principle and he bought this ranch. And he had no use for it. That was the big thing.
Well, right. This ranch ended up falling to him in this particular way. How did the horses end up becoming part of what he did?
Well, soon after he bought the ranch, he met a guy named Dayton Hyde, who was also in South Dakota, because this other ranch was in the sand hills of South Dakota, just over the Nebraska line. And Dayton Hyde brought to Alan's attention the plight of the wild horses. Together, they came up with this idea that they could establish a sanctuary for the horses. But the horses are government-owned, so they had to get approval from the BLM.
Right, and this was not an especially straightforward process.
No, it was rather convoluted. And then the BLM said, "Gosh, we can't grant that. You have to go to Congress to get approval to get the wild horses." And they did. They went to Congress, lobbied Congress, actually went in the halls with their – walked down their, with their cowboy boots, the marbled halls of Congress, and they got the approval.
And you write, and he writes, that that it never occurred to him that he could have hired a lobbyist to do this.
Right. He did it the cowboy way. He cowboyed up and did it himself. So when that approval was granted, the plan was that Alan would get 1,500 wild horses and Dayton Hyde would get 300. Dayton's ranch was in Rapid City, South Dakota. And that's exactly what happened.
He also had to clear some hurdles with the Bureau of Indian Affairs as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The land, Mustang Meadows, used to be owned by the Indians and then and then the white man got it back, and it kind of bounced back and forth, and Alan ended up with this ranch that had previously been owned by Indians, but part of it was still owned by the Rosebud Sioux Indian tribe. And so he had to get approval because he was leasing that land to run the wild horses, and there were a few hiccups in that process.
This was a long story of bureaucracy, essentially.
Yeah, there was a lot of bureaucracy throughout the entire history of the sanctuary.
What did he see as his charge while these horses were in his care? What was his responsibility to them?
Well, he felt that he needed to give them the best possible life that they could have. So he wanted them to have good grass, good grazing, be free to run. I mean, 35,000 acres is a big playground. The challenge was that, like I said before, horses graze, and if they're in a concentrated – live in a concentrated area, they will graze all the grass. So he had to be able to move them between the pastures on the ranch. And that was probably his biggest worry. So he's got this herd of 1,500 wild horses, and how do you move them? I mean, think of training one wild horse. So he put in a training program that he had used on cattle that everyone said, "You can't train cattle."
And he called it gentling.
Gentling the cattle. And he also called it herd behavior modification training. Monty Roberts came along years later and called it horse whispering. So he was able, believe it or not, to train 1,500 wild horses to follow a cowboy on horseback. And he could move them, you know, up to 6 miles, even longer, through gates, across the pasture. He would have this huge herd of horses galloping behind him.
Well, and he was on one level training these horses. He also had a group of people that he had working with him who were not necessarily used to these kinds of techniques.
No, he had to train the cowboys how to train the horses. He had three cowboys, main cowboys. He would have others join in. But what they did was they would bring in 400 horses into a large training arena, and they would approach them and talk to them gently. It didn't matter what they were saying. It mattered the tone of voice. And the horses, they would get within 100 feet, and the horses would bolt to the other end of the corral, and they'd have to do it again. And they would train in 20-minute sessions, maybe four times a day. And within 3 or 4 days, they had those horses gentled.
This sounds like an incredible success story, but unfortunately, this is not a story with an especially happy ending.
No, it's not. Throughout, Alan had the sanctuary for 4 years, and he was always dealing with the Bureau of Land Management. And they would come and evaluate what he was doing, and he would get A-plus ratings. But they would shift their policies a lot. And at the end of the fourth year, they said, you know, you need to rebid on this sanctuary now. And Alan said, what do you mean rebid? Well, you have to – everybody has a chance to have this. So Alan prepared the bid, and it wasn't a happy ending.
How does he view that time in his life and in this point in history? It must be with some conflict.
Well, yes, I think there is some conflict because there were some hard choices he had to make during that time. However, I think it was definitely the highlight of his ranching cowboying career. He just, you know, to have that experience in the Midwest, we're all, you know, from the Midwest, you can just picture it in the summer and these prairies, and to have these wild horses just running behind you and knowing that you're connected with them. He said it just couldn't get better than that. And so even though the ending was not optimal, he said that he would not let anyone destroy those memories, and he would choose to walk away with them intact, knowing that he had done something that no one else had ever done, and he had that experience.
Well, Lynn Wiese Sneed, thank you so much for sharing this
story.
Thank
you, Mitch.
Wild horses couldn't thread me away.
Lynn Wiese Sneed is co-author with Alan Day of The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Wiese Sneed is a Thiensville native who now lives in Tucson, Arizona, which is also where Day resides. She spoke with Mitch Tyke. Alan Day, incidentally, is the brother of former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who wrote the foreword to the book. Lynn Wiese Sneed will talk about wild Mustangs Thursday evening at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and there's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, we're not quite done with horses. Up next, we'll visit a Milwaukee-area factory that makes harnesses. It's the kind of tacky interview you've come to depend on from us, so stay tuned. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. If you've ever driven on Calhoun Road in Brookfield, you might have seen a low-slung building on the west side of the road between North Avenue and Capitol Drive. But the chances are good you've overlooked it. And even if you did notice it, you'd probably have no idea that it's a manufacturing facility for a company that supplies the horse industry worldwide. Walsh Products makes high-end equipment for equestrian riders, harness racing, and other parts of the horse industry, and last month the company marked its 100th anniversary. It originally opened in downtown Milwaukee when the city had a thriving leather tannery industry, but it's long outlived that part of the local economy. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke traveled to Brookfield recently, and many of the company's leaders took a break from their hands-on work to give him a look at everything that goes on in that unassuming building.
My name is Paul Treiber. I am the owner with my wife, Thea Treiber, of the Walsh Company. We bought the Walsh Company about 13 years ago, And we're very proud of our heritage, and we're very proud of making products in the USA, especially in Brookfield, Wisconsin.
Kevin Malezva, I'm the CFO, COO.
Okay.
So I kind of handle the day-to-day operations, basically.
My name's James Browning, and I'm a production manager here. I moved up from Kentucky 3 years ago to help them out. Been doing this for 30 years now.
So what room are we in right now?
This is the shipping department, and this is pretty much the focus of the entire building. Everything comes to this point and ships out to all of our dealers across the world.
And so and we're looking around, and you've got everything from what looks like jackets to...
We do. We have disciplines in the equestrian world. We do a hunter jumper market. We do a show horse market. The bread and butter of our business is the standard bread market with the racehorses. We manufacture halters, you name it. If it goes on a horse, we pretty much make it, with one exception. We don't make saddles. It's the first question everybody asks. Do you make saddles? We do not. There's a lot of other saddle manufacturers that have been outstanding, and we don't need to compete there.
Some of the products you mentioned right here, we also bring in products from Europe, really high-quality products like Walsh. And we have rain suits for jockeys and for show jumping and other disciplines of riding. We also bring in from Italy hunter jumper or jumping boots, race boots from Italy, racing tack. And
from Ireland, we bring in Botanica, which is a topical treatment for skin conditions for animals and humans.
So we're very, very picky, and we kind of cherry-pick the best products out in the marketplace when we travel to Europe.
Walsh is the best of the best, and therefore we will only represent the best of the best.
I'd like to introduce Lindsay Weber.
I am actually sales support, so I help with Susan and then all the rest of our sales reps and then our dealers as well, and I do all of our marketing and advertising. So my favorite part is getting to interact with our sponsored riders, find out what is working for them, what products we can do better on, any new products that they want to bring on, and then help promote those.
Well, and this is radio, so people can't see this, but you're the one person in this room right now that is wearing riding gear.
That is correct. I could sleep in my breeches and tall boots, but I'm a rider myself. I have a show jumper. I've been competing since I was four. I'm much older than that now. But it's great. I love eat, sleep, and breathe Walsh and the equestrianism, I guess you could say. I pretty much should have Walsh tattooed on my chest.
That would be weird.
So
probably not suitable for family radio.
While we're talking about Walsh and products like belts and bracelets, here is Hunter, our yellow lab, who comes to the office almost every day, and he is wearing a Walsh dog collar. We just got into the pet market about 8 months ago to a year ago, and that is something new that Walsh is entering on a private label basis and will be selling through our dealers and tack stores.
One of the things that we do, we manufacture thousands of halters in the course of a week, and all of our customers have the opportunity to personalize those with an engraved nameplate right here. We make the nameplates, we send it out to our dealers, and just another added touch that Walsh offers to our customers.
And so this is the machine that does it.
This is.
Explain for people who really don't have a sense for the gear that goes into riding what the significance of this is.
What Lindsay was speaking to was really our equestrian market. These are really towards our standard bred market. So if anybody is very into racing, this is the cart racing. This isn't the jockeys. That would be more the thoroughbred. So these are the harnesses that are going to go on your horse. This will click into the cart that they are then sitting in, and down the track they go. So this sits on top of the horse's withers. It then has what's called a girth that attaches it, so it's a round circle then, and the bridle is going to go into the horse's mouth and on its head. You're going to have the reins that are going to help that driver steer and slow down at some point, and that's what the saddle is. So it's definitely a different beast than the typical leather saddle that you would consider sitting and riding in.
It's probably the most important piece of the harness, and that's why we use, again, only stainless steel hardware. We've got the best saddle in the market, and it's the most reliable one out there.
Well, and I see in the tag, it says, I can't believe it's not leather, and I was just about to ask you something about sourcing your leather, but this is not leather.
It's interesting. We actually use quite a few different products here. Oftentimes you think horse products and you do think leather, something that we are extremely proud of. All of the hides of leather that we do use are from the United States. However, there's a product that we use that is called a plastic-coated nylon, a biathane material, and it's exactly that. It's a plastic-coated nylon, and what makes it wonderful is that when you're on the tracks and the horses are getting muddy and whatnot, all they have to do is hose it down, and they hang it back in their tack room, and it's done. So it's really taken off in about the last probably 40 years. It was introduced, and it's been a great hit, really, with the standard bred products and the thoroughbred products as well. It's catching on just a bit. So it's the ease of use is really what it's for. The shop is really split up in two separate sections. We just talked about the biathane and that plastic-coated material. It's a lighter material. It's easier to sew. Therefore, it's using not as heavy sewing machines. On the other side is really where we have all of our leather, where Jamie, that you've met, cuts all of the leather by hand. The sewing machines, they're skived. Everything is done on this side, set up again with the heavier, more industrial size machines.
So tell me, what's going on in this room?
This is our manufacturing room. You see now we're getting the hides of leather in. That's how they start. Then we'll strip them to various sizes and skive them down, fold them to length. Then we stitch them on the heavy machines over here.
And this is, as I look around the room, this is not something that, at least at the quality that you're producing, you can automate.
No, it's not. It's a lot of hands-on crafting type stuff.
It takes about anywhere from probably 25 to 40 minutes for us to complete one halter. And that's in a batch of 20, 30, 50, some of our higher volume halters we do in batches of 50. So it is a lengthy process, and you know it's a lot of steps, and it's a lot of care, it's all handwork.
And how many people would touch it from the point it's a big sheet of leather to the point that it's a completed halter?
Probably four different people. We have a cutter, then a prepper, then the stitches, and then a trimmer, and then it's finished.
As the person that manages this whole process, what are the kinds of issues that crop up on a day-to-day basis?
Machine issues sometimes. These old machines will break down.
One of the really unique things about our business is our machines that we use to sew the leather are really, really old. They're very limited edition. There's only a few hundred of them, we're told, that were ever made. So people try to duplicate our products, and they can't quite, you know, get it to match perfectly because they don't have the machines we have.
So, Cam, how long have you been at Welsh Company?
Since 1984.
Going on 30 years.
Yes.
We have some wonderful employees. We've got a lot of longevity with employees. We've got somebody who's been here for 35 years, somebody who's having their 30th anniversary this year, 29, 28. We have been extremely lucky with and you know what? We're a team. So that's the nice thing. They're really not our employees. We consider everybody as part of the Welsh team. And I think they're just great hard workers, and we've been extremely blessed to have them.
I like the Welsh, and people here are very nice, and the owner, and I enjoy working here, so that's why I'm staying around.
This is Dave Zacharias. He is our production manager. Dave has been with the company for 35 years, so Dave has a ton of history from when the company was in downtown Milwaukee and when it moved out to Brookfield.
Let me ask, how much have things changed and how much have things not changed?
Well, for one thing, quality never changes. And if you have a good product with quality and you take pride in it, people will always come back. We have a lot of new product lines. We've had to adapt to the economies. You know, we had a bit of a recession back in the 80s, and we had to adapt to that. The employees that we have are international company. People from all over, Puerto Rico, South America, Southeast Asia, Europe.
We hear a lot about, you know, they talk about the skills gap and how companies have a difficult time finding skilled workers. Do you have any trouble finding the quality of workers that you need?
Typically, we could find people with sewing experience. The machines in our leather area pose a little bit different problem because there's nobody we're going to find who has experience on those machines. So luckily, we've been pretty lucky finding some guys that aren't afraid of them, for one thing, because they're a little scary. But if they've done any kind of sewing, they usually do pretty well on them.
Let me get back to the machines for a minute. And obviously, technology has come a long way in 100 years, and there are probably places that are capable of making all new sewing machines. What is it about these 100-year-old machines that makes them the right thing for the job?
These are harness stitchers, so they have an awl that comes down and pierces the leather, and the needle comes up through the bottom, like you're hand stitching, versus today's machines are a typical rotary machine. One needle goes down and locks the thread on the inside.
And really no need to go out and find a company to recreate something like this when it already exists?
Well, I don't think there's probably the demand to accommodate that in today's market.
You know, the world is a different place than it was 100 years ago when it comes to humans and how they treat animals. How does the way your equipment feels to the horse fit in with what you do, or does it?
Well, we and all of our new projects and the existing equipment's been around for so long, we care more about the animals as we are doing research and design on the products. Like I said, we work with some of the world-class riders, drivers, and trainers in all of our disciplines, and we will not make a product that would hurt a horse. We make a product that makes a horse happy. It's really, really important in our industry that people know us, for the quality, the safety, and that it makes the animal healthy, happy, and for the safety factor.
Your horse is going to perform better, hands down, if it's wearing something that's comfortable. So in the manufacturing of all of our products, we are keeping the horse first and foremost in mind, as well as the safety of the riders and drivers, because our products have to be comfortable for the horse, but also incredibly safe.
What makes a good day at Walsh for you?
I can absolutely 100% say that every day is a good day, because I walk in and every morning I am so proud of what we do. Giving people a tour of our shop gives me the chills. After 10 years, it still amazes me that it turns from a hide of leather into the beautiful quality that we manufacture. It's amazing that we do it right here in Brookfield.
Does anything keep you up at night?
You know, no, I don't. I think every day is going to be a challenge. That's one of the things that is part of business. But they're good challenges. And from that, we learn every day. We'll stumbling blocks, but every time we come out ahead. So, yeah, I think it's been awesome.
The biggest learning curve in this industry was taking an older company and bringing it into some newer sections where the company could grow. That's where we entered into the English show jumping market. Now we're heading into the pet market, and those were the challenges we had. The biggest challenge overall, though, was putting the right team together and having a team that really works together. And I try to involve everybody in the most, almost all the major decisions. Sometimes we don't all agree. A lot of times we disagree. But I think through that process, we make really good decisions. It's always fun to grow the business, but it is at times very challenging. But that's what makes it very special for me and Thea to come to work, and Kevin, Jamie, to come to work every day.
Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke produced our interview on Brookfield's Walsh Products, which makes equipment for equestrians, harness racers, and other parts of the horse and pet industries. The company marked its 100th anniversary last month, and you can see pictures of their century-old leather stitching equipment at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then hear about a new novel based on the very real life of German painter Gabriele Münter. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company today. The Kandinsky retrospective currently on view at the Milwaukee Art Museum is a visual delight. Organized by the museum and the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the show traces Wassily Kandinsky's artistic evolution across his entire career. Also included in the exhibit are some works by artists associated with Kandinsky, including the German painter Gabriele Münter. Münter was an accomplished artist in her own right, but she was also Kandinsky's lover for a number of years. Once the relationship ended, she became the guardian of many of Kandinsky's works created between 1908 and 1914, called the Blue Rider period. She ended up hiding them from the Nazis during the Second World War. Münter's art and her story fascinated Milwaukee author and museum docent Mary Basson. Her novel Saving Kandinsky is the result. I asked Basson why she chose to write a historical novel rather than a biography.
When I learned about the story of Gabriele Münter and Wassily Kandinsky, I was arrested by the drama of the situation. I was taken by the throat. I could hardly wait to try to capture the essence of the character, if I could. It was important to me to dramatize her story. Artists have had their conflicts in life with each other, with their love lives, with society, and I wanted to let readers see that and feel that.
But the story itself is so compelling, as you say. I just wonder what bringing it into a novel, fictionalizing it somewhat, allowed you to do that you wouldn't have been able to do if you had stayed in the true biography.
Well, I think I could get into the head of the characters, particularly Ella. I could try to understand what she felt when she tried so hard to make him love her and have him marry her, and then the disaster when he didn't. I wanted to capture her inner thoughts and feelings.
How much of what happened there is in the historical record? How far did you stray from it?
I strayed very little. Almost everything is in the historical record. The parts that are not are the parts that are inside her head, the dialogues that we couldn't know if we hadn't been there, the inner turmoil. But the exterior movement of the novel is very close to the historical record.
He doesn't come off very well.
No, he does not.
And he, of course, is the most famous name, although she left behind a really impressive body of work, some of which is here at the museum.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Milwaukee Art Museum owns 14 paintings by Münter. She was much beloved by Mrs. Bradley, and we're grateful that Mrs. Bradley had that eye. Americans don't know much about Gabriele Münter, although she's quite famous in Europe, particularly, naturally, in Germany. But Mrs. Bradley had the eye to see what she brought to the art.
And what did she bring to painting?
An innocence, an eye for color, a particular interest in form. And she was one of those artists in the early part of the 20th century who were struggling to understand what they must represent of the natural world and what they could contribute from their own spirits. She did a lot of what I call subtracting. She removed pieces of the natural world that she saw and attempted to get at its essence.
And you talk about that in the novel, some of her interior dialogue. She's actually doing that as she's painting. She's saying, you know, what can I take away? How can I do this? You have her say she doesn't ever succeed. In her mind, at least in the novel, she never actually succeeded in the way that Kandinsky did. Did she really feel that way? Do you know?
I think she must have felt some of those qualities. She was a talented artist, and she had much to say and much to contribute. But after all, he was a genius. And I think about what that must mean to live with a genius. You yourself are smart. You have make a contribution. You're talented. You have something to say. In many circles, Gabriele Münter would be much admired. But she was associated with Kandinsky, and he was something of another order of being. I think she felt herself to be less than she really was.
So instead of her association with him making her rise to the occasion, you think it, she actually felt diminished in some way by it?
Well, I think she did rise to the occasion for a long time. They painted quite a bit alike for many years. They traveled together and they saw the same scenes and they depicted them similarly and they talked endlessly about what art should be. But then he moved forward. He broke through the boundaries of art that had been established by the Academy and by other artists of the time. It was a vision few people could replicate, at least at that time, at 1910, 1912, 1914. He was going beyond what anybody was doing.
I found it fascinating as I was reading the book to try to imagine what it must have been like to live with somebody that single-minded. She was single-minded too, but in a different way.
Yeah, very different way. What I observed about her, and she reports in her diary and is written about her by others, she was an intuitive painter. She didn't necessarily know what she was painting. It just came out of her. She is described by her second lover as being like a bird who just sings because it knows not why. He, on the other hand, was highly conscious. He was a professor. He was a scholar. He was a writer. And he prepared his artworks in a way she wouldn't have known to do. For example, when he painted Composition 7, a fragment of which is in the Milwaukee Art Museum, he made 33 studies for this abstract piece that we might look at and think it was impulsively dashed out. But au contraire, it was highly thought of, highly prepared for with these numerous sketches. He lived in his head in a way she didn't.
What got you interested in her? What's the genesis of this book?
I spent my whole career as an English teacher, a high school English teacher. I was at the university school, and I was immersed in story. I didn't know much about art. And when I was getting ready to retire, worried that I wouldn't know how to spend my time the way some retired people feel, I joined the docent program at the art museum. Docents in that class are asked to come down twice a week and learn about the collection and learn about art history and how to present art to the visitors to the museum. Our first homework assignment was to go into the galleries and find a piece of art that we liked and start to learn about it. Well, I hardly knew what to like. I wandered around aimlessly, not knowing what to look at. And when I came upon Munter's painting Boating, done in 1910, the image of which is on the cover of Saving Kandinsky, I was gripped. Here was a story. I didn't know what the story was, but there was a story here. There's a man standing up, piercing eyes, looking at us. He's standing in a rowboat. And if there's one thing you know about a rowboat is you don't stand up in a rowboat. And the person who's doing the rowing has her back to us. And who are these people? I said to myself. And I made quite a few wrong guesses until I did the research and found that this was an image of Kandinsky with his dominant persona projected on the painting. And the rower is Gabriela Munter. She's doing the work with her back to us, her face invisible to us. I was captured by that story.
How important was her work and her support, her rowing the boat, to his success?
She was his colleague, and in the early days, in 1908 and 9 and 10, when they were together, along with a number of other artists, struggling to define themselves in the early part of the 20th century, they were peers. They were equals. They were colleagues. They talked about the same things. They often used, it seems to me, the same palette. If you see some of their artwork side by side from the early teens, you see the same shadings and colors. I think she was very important, and she was part of the group that talked about breaking through to the new forms. She was a member of the Blaue Reiter in German, the Blue Reiter. She was a member of that. So she was very important to him for a while, and he regarded her as his helpmate. She kept a list of his art in what she called her hand list. She photographed his work. One of the amazing things for me is that she photographed Composition 7 when he was painting it. And it's a huge painting. It's over 6 feet wide. It's hanging now in I think it's Tetyakov Gallery in Russia. He painted it in 4 days. And she photographed the process. So you see what it looked like after a few hours, and you see what it looked like the next day, and then again the next day. That he could paint such an enormous painting in 4 days is, first of all, testimony to the fact that he did prepare with all those sketches. But I like to think of her with her camera, after all, kind of a new technology, and she as a woman was adept at using it. She'd had a camera since she was a young girl. I see her taking pictures of his work and supporting him in that.
Well, we get then to the actual title of the book, which is Saving Kandinsky. And this is directly from the historical record, is it not?
It is definitely from the historical record.
What happened?
When the Nazis came to power in the early 30s, they were trying to establish among the German people a point of view toward art. Hitler was himself a failed painter, a sort of a sentimental painter, and they were trying to craft a German spirit. They burned books, as we know, in Berlin in 1933, and in 1937, they organized the Degenerate Art Exhibit. The Degenerate Art Exhibit was held in a ramshackle building in Munich, and it consisted of works that the Nazis had confiscated from galleries and museums around the country, works that they regarded as in opposition to the ideals of the German spirit, works that were full of social criticism or that were abstract or that in any way violated their aesthetic. At the same time that the German the Degenerate Art Exhibit was being held, they had built another art museum, the Haus der Kunst, quite near the Degenerate Art Building. And there Hitler installed the artworks that he admired, classical artworks, images from Greece and Rome. He liked the thought of a picture of a girl in pigtails on the mountain with a cow. I mean, he didn't want the kind of challenging art that the degenerate artists represented. So she knew, she, Gabriele Munter, had been to the Degenerate Art Exhibit. She knew what was happening to paintings, and she had in her possession over 100 works by Kandinsky and other members of the Blue Rider. She had them because Kandinsky had left her in 1914 at the outbreak of World War I. He was Russian. She was German. He was an enemy alien. He had to get out of town. She had his works still in her possession. When she understood that the Nazis were destroying painting, she could have let them destroy those artworks. She could have given them to the Nazis. But instead, she carted them all to her small house in the foothills of the Bavarian Alps, and she hid them very carefully. And indeed, the Nazis came looking for them. They were aware of her association with Kandinsky, her long association. They came looking for Kandinsky's works, partly to destroy them, and after all, partly to sell them to fund the Nazi war chest. It was a dual mission here. So they came to her house, and she managed to hide them from these Nazis who came. So she indeed saved Kandinsky.
Mary Basson is the author of the novel Saving Kandinsky, which is based on the life of German painter Gabriele Munter. Basson is a retired English teacher and currently serves as a docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum, which houses the largest collection of Munter's paintings in North America. You can hear Basson read an excerpt from Saving Kandinsky at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.